Hi, I'm Tanya Maybrook. Welcome to the first in our Taras HaMashpacha series of refresher classes. Last week we celebrated Rosh Chodesh Adar. Rosh Chodesh is often referred to as the woman's Yom Tov. Why is that? Various reasons are given. One reason is that physiologically, a woman's menstrual cycle parallels the monthly cycles of the moon. Women are therefore especially attuned to the Yom Tov of Rosh Chodesh. Essentially, both have a message of renewal and of the cycles of life. We're told that women are pturos from mitzvos asei shehazman grama. Women are not obligated to keep time-bound mitzvos. And there are reasons given, Chazal explained basically. That is because, as women, our time is not our own. Many of us experience this, definitely once we're married, we're always running, always rushing to catch up with ourselves and all of our responsibilities, and we just don't have enough time to have these fixed mitzvos that would be time-bound. Rav Shem Shmuel Hirsch, living in the 19th century, gave us another insight into why mitzvos asei shehazman grama are not binding upon women. He explains that men need these mitzvos so that they could appreciate the significance of time and value every moment to be sanctifying to Avodas Hashem. But women, according to Rav Hirsch, don't need time-bound mitzvos like the men because we have one quintessential time-bound mitzvah, the mitzvah of Taras HaMashpacha. It's all about timing. So many things about Taras HaMashpacha relate to time. We're so conscious of what day of the cycle we're in, what day is the Ona or Veses, when will it fall out, what day is Zion Nikiyim we're in, what's the time of Shkia. We become experts in these things, just to name a few. So Nida is uniquely our time-bound mitzvah, par excellence. And if you think about it, even in terms of the mitzvahs that are specifically known to be women's mitzvahs, the acronym is Chana, Ches for Chala, Hafreshes Chala, Nun for Nida, and Hey for Halakas Haneros. So being Hafresh the Chala, doing Taras HaMashpacha, and lighting candles are uniquely mitzvot granted to women. But we know a male baker is mafresh challah. And if we wouldn't be able to light the candles, let's say a woman was in the hospital for whatever reason, hopefully to give birth, her husband could light the Shabbos candles. But only a woman could do the halachos related to nida. So this is our mitzvah, a woman's mitzvah. These shiurim, over the course of the next 3 weeks, are meant as a refresher, not to replace good Kala classes. Although they are refresher courses, and we're going to be comprehensive, hopefully, we're going to go much faster than usual and might not have as much hashkafa as you would want. So feel free to jump in and pose your questions, or, I would prefer, actually, because of the sake of time, write them down. And then, at given intervals, I'll address whatever questions are on your mind. The signs did not say specifically what the topics of each shiur will be, so I'll share them with you now. The reason we organized topics in the way that we did is just to maximize how much we can put into each class of 2 hours. So, tonight's class is going to be about 5 ways that a woman can become a nida, and about the process of becoming Tahora, essentially Zion Nikiyim and surrounding issues. Class 2 by Dr. Afrat Sabolovsky is going to be on Mikvah and Vestos. And class 3 by Revinson Peshin Neuberger is going to be on Harchakos and issues of marital intimacy. Many of you have already submitted questions to sharequestions@gmail.com. So feel free to continue to do so, and we're responding to them according to the appropriate class. For those of you who don't yet have the notes on the first topic, 5 ways to become Nidah, please look around and try to find an extra book that there should be some circulating. And I've provided these notes to you. I'm not going to cover only what's listed in those notes, but it's a note-taking guide. The pressure should be off you to take down every word I say, and you should follow along on the key sources that I have for you. But basically, it's a take-home package that you can go and review on your own with your husband. So first of all, what's the background of the term Nidah? Where does it come from? If you look in Sefer Vayikra, Perek Pinchas, Pasuk Yutes, it says, Elisha b'nidas tumasa lo sikrav legarlos ermasa. When a woman is in her impure status of being a nida, a man should not approach her to expose her nakedness. And that relates to a prohibition of marital intimacy and Chazal explain also of other forms of physical contact. What is the ramification if a couple does do this? See the next source in Vayikra Perek Chav, Pasuk Yuches. V'ish asher yishkav es isha davar. If a man sleeps with a woman during her period, v'gila es erbasa, and he exposes her nakedness, es mekora ha'era, he exposed her source of her period, v'hi galsa es mekor dama, and she did likewise expose the source of her bleeding, v'nefrasu shnehem mikarem amon. Both will be spiritually cut off in some way. To gain perspective on this status of Anita being Tumeya, we have to go back to the times of the Beis HaMikdash. So we have a perspective on it. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, it had many more ramifications than it does today. Today, as we'll discuss, it involves a woman separating from her husband temporarily and having to keep track of certain issues, numbers of days, and then going through a process of tahora and culminating with going to the mikvah. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, there were many other ramifications to the woman's status as a nida. She was tumea, so she could not partake of trumos and maasros and come into contact with holy objects. But it wasn't only unique to a woman. Even a man who had an emission of semen would likewise be tamei, and he'd have to go to a mikvah. He wouldn't have to wait like we do 7 days, you know, the Zion King. But he would likewise have to go to a mikvah. But that's not highlighted today, because today, men and women are all tameim, because we're tameimes. And today we don't have trumos and maasros. We don't have, unfortunately, tzareinu, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So we don't see those other ramifications. But the fact that the woman's tameya is not unique, in the sense that what does the tumah come from? Comes from the fact that it signals a loss of life or a loss of potential. It is a void that exists in the absence of kedusha, or that which exudes potential. So, for example, a menstruation or a nida results in the loss of the egg that was not fertilized. And likewise, if the man emits semen, it's the loss of that potential that could have been in life. To be rendered anida means that a woman has blood that comes from the uterus, or the makor, in the pasuk, the source of life. To paraphrase Chazal, to be anida, it has to be dam shayata min hamakor. But hold on to your seats. I'm going to say something many of you might never have heard. The opposite is not true. That is, according to the Torah, not all uterine blood renders a woman a nida. Okay, I'll repeat that. That means just because blood comes from the uterus does not mean the woman is necessarily a nida min ha-Torah. Perhaps we'll see mida rabbanan, she could become a nida. But not according to the Torah is it always the case. Let's see clarification below. What are the 5 ways to become a nida? The first category is the onset of menstruation. This category is derived, as we saw, from Sukkim in the Torah, and it refers to a woman's expected cycle of menstruation. It pertains to halachos of vessels that will be covered next week. This is essential. A woman has to know when she's expecting her normal period. To do that, she has to mark on the Hebrew day when she has had her period, to know in the future when it would be. Well, this is more to be discussed in more detail next week with the subject of Esther, but she has to know if her period started before or after Shia. This is just a brief overview. Then she would have to count a minimum of 5 days of harchakos. By the way, not 5 days of bleeding, and we're going to cover this again. 5 days of harchakos. See why the two don't are not synonymous. And she has to count 7 spotless days. She would consider the first day of her period as day number 1 for the minimum of the 5 days usually. That's the time that she became anita, is also the time that she started keeping her harchakos. So let's use a case scenario. A woman sees that she becomes anita on Sunday, and it's 4:55 p.m. and Shia is at 5 o'clock. So when does she count day number 1 of her period, or status as anita? Sunday. But Sunday is only 5 minutes. 5 minutes? Yes. That equals a day, halachically. But if it's after Shia, even if it's only a few minutes after Shia, Monday is her day number 1. What if she has a suffix? She has a question. She doesn't know exactly when her period came. She uses the later time zone to record when she got her period. That's the first category of becoming anita. The second category, and the third, need the following introduction. It pertains to what I said before. The second category of hargasha and the third of a kesem refer to cases of mid-cycle bleeding. That is, sometime between two periods, two official periods. It's important to note this. According to the Torah, the only way that a woman can become anita in the middle of her cycle is if she experiences a hargasha, a specific physical sensation, and then she sees blood that came from her uterus. So we see in the source, in Gemara Nidah Daf Nun Zayin Amud Beis, Shene Amar, in the Torah it says, Bivsara, in her flesh. And the Gemara explains, Ad shetargish bivsara. In the middle of her cycle, she could only become anita if she feels the physical sensation of some sort. We'll describe what kind of sensation this is. Moda shmuel shehit meya midrabanan. But if she doesn't feel that, in the ellipsis, there was a larger discussion there. If a woman doesn't feel a hargasha in the mid-cycle, but does experience uterine bleeding, at most, she would be anita midrabanan. And this is significant. We'll discuss why. Since she is anita midrabanan, the rabbanim were able to allow women certain leniencies if she bleeds in the middle of her cycle. And the rabbanim maintained that even if she could not apply these leniencies to her situation, then she would be considered anita midrabanan, because Chazal wanted to safeguard against a couple erring, making a mistake, when she might actually be anita according to the Torah. So it's a safeguard that the rabbanim created. Keep this in mind when we learn about possible loopholes. Okay, so second category now, hargasha. What is a hargasha? A hargasha is a very, very specific feeling. It's not a cramp, it's not a headache, PMS headache, it's not nausea, it's not lower back pain or breast tenderness. It's associated with very specific feelings. Many rabbanim feel that these feelings don't occur today. Women don't feel them. Somehow we've lost some sensation or being in touch with our body in this way. Or our experience of a period occurs differently than it used to. Physiology has changed over time. So what are the specific feelings that used to be described? They were phenomena in existence. Nizdazu emareha. She feels a bodily tremor. Or psichas harechem, she feels the opening of the uterus. and a zivas gavar lach, and something high up internally, a feeling of a boisterous discharge. So zivas gavar lach is not the same thing as feeling some kind of flow, as Rabbi Reisman once pointed out. The woman, the moisture she feels flowing is something that would be cold if she went outside, but that's slowed down. We're talking about a flow that would be very high up near the cervix. Women don't usually feel this today. So women's physiology has changed. It used to be, if a woman felt these two sensations, she would have to do a bedika to determine if there was a bloody discharge from the uterus. But today, most poskim maintain women do not feel these kinds of hargashos. If she gets her period, she would become aware of it, but in the middle of her cycle, if she doesn't feel a hargasha, it is not a problem in Hatorah. So you're going to ask me the obvious question. If this doesn't usually happen, why are we learning about it? Okay, having a hargasha and seeing blood designates a woman into a nida min haTorah. So we have to be stringent in three situations. In cases where a woman is doing something at the time that she sees blood. Again, we're talking in the middle of the cycle when it's not her period. And if a woman is doing something at the time that she experiences spotting, and she's doing something that would have masked or camouflaged a potential hargasha, as we classified, then there are serious ramifications. She is in the status of a suffix nida mid'oraisa. So for example, if a woman is doing some kind of internal check, she's doing an official bedika in the middle of her cycle, which she shouldn't be, but just having said that, this is what would happen if, in theory, she would do a bedika or insert a tampon, something that's done internally, and she takes the object out and she sees spotting. So even though it's the middle of her cycle and she doesn't expect her period, since the spotting that she sees is likely to be uterine, she'd have to determine that it wasn't, that she would not become an eater, but likely it was uterine and was done in the context of putting something inside her internally, which could mask those other feelings we're talking about. She, in the act of putting the decocal or a tampon inside her, experienced, in theory, a discharge or opening of the uterus. She might not feel it. She might not be in touch with it. Because, in theory, she could experience such a hargasha. At that same time, this relegates the whole situation into a suffix mid'oraisa, and Chazal cannot be Miko on it. So that's situation number one. Women usually are trained not to do these kinds of things and look at them, like inserting a tampon mid-cycle and looking at it. So hopefully that doesn't occur. But very commonly is in the process of urinating, going to the bathroom, woman uses toilet paper. Again, we're told not to look. Many college teachers just tell her, don't look. And I can't begin to tell you, I've heard from very religious women that they have gone to the bathroom in the middle of their cycle, seen blood on the tissue, and flushed it right down the toilet. And I'm shocked. And I say, do you realize you're like in a potential suffix nida mid'oraisa when you do that? And you're just throwing that status away? You don't even call up the rabbi and ask a shaila? Why is that? And so I come to the conclusion that they don't realize how serious it is, that you're in the situation of a suffix nida mid'oraisa if, in the act of going to the bathroom, blood comes on the tissue. Why is that? Again, one of these three unique cases. In the act of urination, it can mask a potential feeling of the zivas gavar lach, of something internal coming down. And so, because in theory she could have felt that feeling, but it was masked by her urination, that's why when she sees the spotting, it's that unique situation that mid'oraisa puts her in potential status of a nida. So she's a suffix nida mid'oraisa. However, once you ask the shayla, you'll see that there are various ways a rav can be miko on that specific situation, but it's not up to us to pass it for ourselves because it's such a serious circumstance. we should train, first of all, not to look when we go to the bathroom, but secondly, to ask Shilas about it. Some of the recommendations that the Rav will give her when he talks to her about it is, aside from not looking, getting into the habit of being relaxed and not rushing through the process of urinating and wiping, but having 3 to 5 seconds delay so that if she would see blood on the tissue, one of the mitigating factors not to render her a nida, would be that there was a time delay between the act, the sensation of urination, and seeing the blood. So far, everyone's on the same page? Okay. So now, the third situation is intercourse. In the act of intercourse, something's inserted into the woman, so it could mask all these types of percussions. If, in theory, the couple had intercourse and immediately afterwards you saw spotting, that's a suffix nida midoraisa, because it's in the context of an act that could have masked that potential hargasha. So it's very serious. A couple could avoid putting themselves into the suffix nida midoraisa category by merely delaying, again, just like the advice for the urination, just delay, don't open your eyes, don't look, wait a couple of minutes. In theory, if you would see spotting, hopefully it would be on colored material and so on, and would be in the third category that we're coming to right now. And if that would be the situation, they would be able to, with the time delay, be in the fourth category of a keset, which would have other reasons to make the situation more lenient. So, just to review, are we trying to beat the system? Are we trying to beat the system by telling women not to look at the toilet paper or not to look post-intercourse? Are we trying to, like, get out of something? No, this is the system. The system is that she's in the realm of a suffix nida midoraisa, so if she is, we have to be stringent. But we could avoid these situations, and then she would not be a nida midoraisa, but rather only in the status of and in that realm, the Rabban created their own leniencies for the woman. Yes? Yes. That's an excellent question. The question, for those of you who didn't hear it, is if one experiences a certain, like, identifying factor, a sensation, before every period that signals the onset of the period, should she ignore it? Okay, I have to tell you, your question is an excellent question, and you're going to have it addressed in the issue of vessels. Because what you're talking about is a certain kind of vessels, a certain kind of habitual signal of an expected period. So that goes into the realm of the vessels, and so you may be required to do a bitika. But that's not the subject of the same, it's not the same as the discussion that we're having. I guess it could be related in some way, but I would categorize that in the subject of vessels, if you want to think about it like that. Okay. So now the third category is a kesem, some kind of stain. A stain that the woman finds on her underwear, her bedding, her body. She didn't feel when it came, there was no hagasha, in other words, and she's unaware of its origins and its nature. It's not linked to a period. Since we don't know the cause of the stain, there are 5 criteria to determine if it's problematic. And we need all 5 factors for it to be a problem. The size of the stain, the color of the stain, the color of material it's on, that it fell on something that could be makabel tuma, and that it's not definitely associated with another cause. So let's go through each one. The size of the stain. For a kesem to be problematic, midrabanan, it would have to be the size of a gris or a United States penny. If so, it would be a problem. What if there were a bunch of stains and each one wasn't the size of a penny, but they were in close proximity? Then ask a shayla, because the small unconnected stains could be seen as a whole, halachically, if they were in close location to one another. If you're unsure, then just ask in relation to the size. The color of the stain. Let's talk about colors for a second. What colors are we talking about? The following categories you have before you. First category, if it is red, blackish, maroon, or purple, the woman is most likely Anita. I could say she is Anita for all intents and purposes, but if you have any doubt, always ask. Most likely she would be Anita. Why? All four of these colors have very strong red highlights. The next category, the opposite extreme, white, off-white, pale yellow, all these kinds of colors, if you see them on any kind of garment, even later when we talk about decos, same thing applies, that would not render the woman Anita. Browns, pinks, deep golden yellows or oranges, all have in common the fact that they have highlights of red. We might not have trained eyes to see those highlights, but they could very well be there. So it's a question. She could fall into a question of being Anita, so she has to ask. Fourth, you might never have experienced, but I have been told by a woman, green or blue discharge. So that also is warranting a shayla to a doctor, because such discharge is a sign of infection. Hopefully it doesn't occur and it wouldn't be a problem of Anita. So when you're looking at these colors, avoid pass-getting for yourself if there's any question. Certainly when you're getting the hang of what to ask, be on the safe side and ask rather than render yourself more stringently into some kind of status like Anita because you didn't ask. When Rabbanim look at these colors, just know two things. First of all, the longer that the color sits on cloth, the better the color looks. Very often it fades over time. So they're looking at the most faded color. Secondly, they're looking at it in sunlight. Colors look extremely different in fluorescent lighting like this and in sunlight. So realize that what looks to us like red very well might not likely be halachically red. And we should not paskin for ourselves because we're usually doing it l'chomra. Yeah. The better it looks, the longer it sits. Exactly. When we first do the, let's say, we're not talking about bedikos here, but when we do anything and we see spotting, we see something on a bedikah cloth, it looks usually much worse than it looks in a couple of hours, especially the next day, fades. That's okay. We want the, if it's truly a problem, it will still be there. I assure you, that those red highlights will be there. Okay. The color of the material it's found on, it's only a problem if it's found on a white cloth. Because anything colored, we can't distinguish precisely what the color is, so automatically it wouldn't be a problem. Pastels are okay, off-whites, avoid. Meaning if you get a package and there's an off-white pair of underwear, probably wouldn't want to use it when you're not needed. Now, Chazal were lenient in the cases of a kesem because it doesn't occur with any kind of hergasha or any action that could have masked a potential hergasha. Thus, she would only be a Nida Midrabanan, and that's why Chazal themselves create the leniencies. Lest you doubt what I'm saying, the words of the Ramah, the Feirushir, and Yerodea, Simon Kuf Tzadi, Sifyot, listen to his language, Lefichach, Til Bash Ha'isha, Big Day Tzimonim. Therefore, because the Chazal, the Rabbanan, understood it in this way, she should wear colored garments, to save herself from spotting. So they were concerned that the woman would have spotting issues and render herself Anita unnecessarily. And that's why the Rabbanim themselves created these leniencies, this category of being Anita in the middle of one cycle, without a context of a hargasha, is only a context of Anita Mirjabalaman, and that's why they created their own leniencies. Yes, question. I'm not
Okay, this is what I'm going to compare it to. Okay, so let's use the analogy. Think about radiation. Okay, you can't see radiation. We believe it exists. We avoid it at all costs with tremendous ramifications. I worked in a DNA lab. I worked with radioactive materials. How many precautions we took, I can't even tell you. We go near anything that had potential contact with radiation. We couldn't even see it. But why do I believe that it's a problem? Because I'm told medically it's a problem. So to hear, I'm told spiritually to not keep it tall levels, so spiritually it's a problem then. The love and essence of the spiritual doctor is telling me if it's a problem or not. So I'm trusting his, you know, assessment, and I'm going to be quite careful to avoid putting myself in a potentially spiritually unsafe situation. It's not. What you just said is exactly what I said in the share. Not all uterine blood renders women into. I think that common myth is what makes women very confused. It's not true. I'll prove it to you when we talk about childbirth. That myth has hope. A woman can be weak and be tough. Okay? I'm showing it to you. It's right out of the Torah. She can have uterine blood and she's okay post childbirth. So I'm telling you, the fish. According to Torah, she could have a grandpa that does not run to her window. Okay, yeah, question. Okay, so I asked Rabbi Mordechai Woodland about this. I teach Halas and talk to him about Ikru and Ivory. And listen, he maintains the following. We have the principle of Lechatzila, right? At the outset of something, a busy after the fact. So, lechatzila, avoid ivory or white. After the fact, perhaps there would be a rug who would be lenient. Because it's not pure white. Light things are fine. Totally not in the family of white. Okay. Yeah, great question. Okay, great. Okay, I'm repeating the question. I'm sorry I didn't do that before. Repeating this excellent question. So, question was, if there is a colored garment and it has white areas in it, should one use that garment when one is not an eater? You're risking it, right? You're risking that, in theory, there could be spotting on that exact white part. Like if you have sheep, multicolored, and there's some white spots, if you're theory-wearing underwear that has some white spots, you're risking that you might spot in the exact place that they're white. So you should avoid that. But use your judgment. I mean, I would say avoid it. Why put yourself into a situation of anxiety? But if the white is so insignificant, it's not any large spots of white, so it's up to you. It's a very good question. It comes up often. Okay, so what's the strategy? Always wear colored and use colored garments except during Zion Nicaea, as we'll discuss later. So, just based upon shilas that my husband has received over years, I have a few comments or suggestions. We all realize for undergarments we should be wearing colored. But anything close to the body has to be colored. So we've had shilas of black leggings that had white crotches and that spotted on the white crotch. That's a problem. Black tights, so too, that had a white crotch would be a problem. Bedding, very good. They have navy or denim bedding, but that white mattress pad underneath sometimes has spotting. So they go to change the sheet and then they see the spot right on the white mat. My suggestion is the following, preventative. If you see spotting, hopefully your sheets are not dark enough that it would totally camouflage a spot. If you see spotting, don't take your sheets off and throw them in the laundry. Wash your sheets on the bed, and at the same time, you'll hopefully be washing out that stain on the white mattress pad because it would be difficult to be lenient on the white mattress pad. Okay? Or just be careful when you wash the white mattress pad to just throw it into the wash without looking at it. Okay. On the body, what is the question?
After the fact,
Oh, good, great. We all learn from one another. So the advice given is, when the woman is not in Midah and she wants to make sure she doesn't stain on anything light, including a mattress pad, put a towel under your sheets so that it would be absorbing anything. Great, great suggestion. Okay, what about kefim on one's body, on skin? The color of your skin is irrelevant. I've had that question, so it's not such a silly thing. Okay, it doesn't matter what color your skin is. No one has pure skin. The issue is more how close the stain is in proximity to the vaginal opening, to where it could have, in theory, been uterine blood. So I'm not going to go into it. I'd rather, if there would be a situation where one stains on one's body, call up your rug and discuss the exact location of the spot, and you'll figure out if it's something that would potentially be a question. What about it being on an item that's makabel tuma? It has to be on an item that's makabel tuma. So know this. Know this in order to be empowered to ask shaylos. I'm not giving you license to decide on your own in all situations, but in order to educate you, to ask shaylos and to know what information to offer, know that disposable things are not makabel tuma. Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva discusses this, that pads, toilet paper, officially are not makabel tuma, and so many poskim use, Rav Moshe himself used this not on its own, but in connection with other reasons to be lenient when a woman sees some spot on toilet paper in the middle of the cycle, or on pads in the middle of the cycle, in connection with other reasons to be lenient. It's not on its own, but b'tziruf, or in connection with other reasons to be lenient, a rav may be lenient, in line with his Rav Moshe. But keep in mind, as we said, that with toilet paper, it's such a serious issue. She's in a potential suffix, needs a midaraisa, that it's not enough to be lenient according to many posts. You can't just rely on the Rav Moshe that, oh, toilet paper isn't makabel tuma. Most rabbanim wanted also with a time delay and maybe other things. So keep that in mind. It might be helpful to know also that the toilet itself is not makabel tuma. So in theory, if you saw spotty on the toilet, it's not makabel tuma, so it's a reason to be lenient. Okay. What about being attributed? Yes, question. So I'm saying that in order for a kesem to be a problem, it has to be on something that is mekabel tuma, that can't accept tuma. So according to Rav Moshe, that's a reason to be lenient with spotting on pads or on toilet paper. But even Rav Moshe himself and those who understand Rav Moshe only apply this in situations where there are also other mitigating factors. So we cannot just use pads in the middle of the cycle and spot and just ignore it, discuss it with your rav. In a specific context, after the fact, it may be okay. But that's what, because there are serious ramifications and you can't just rely on this Rav Moshe without any other mitigating factors, we are told not to look at the toilet paper, specifically the toilet paper. It's more problematic than the pad because, as you said, it's in a situation that masks a potential harkasha. But even in the case of a pad, it would only a reason to ask the shayla, knowing that you may not be a nida. I don't want women to render themselves a nida because they don't realize that there are reasons to be lenient. I'm not telling you, again, to patkin for yourself, but rather I'm motivating you to ask the question. Okay. It also, in order for the spotting to render the woman a nida, cannot be attributed to another cause. So if it could be attributed to another cause, it could render her a nida. If it was a maka, she had some cut, irritation, we know for a fact, then it can render her a nida. Women sometimes have bleeding on the toilet paper, but they know they have a problem of hemorrhoids. So if they can attribute it to hemorrhoids, that the bleeding is obviously not uterine, it's not a problem. Or it could be they know they have vaginal irritation, the doctor already noted it, then it might not be a problem. If the doctor noted it, it wouldn't be a problem. But you can't just assume if you feel an irritation that that's what it's attributed to. So look into if that is able to be proven. What if it's attributed to another cause? It's not a maka, it's makeup, it's clothing dyes. One time my husband had a shaila and he said, this is not natural red. It's red, it's no doubt red, but this is not a natural red. And they were in connection, in affiliation with another rub, they were able to ascertain that this was something from, I don't know, some makeup substance, something, and just happened to be on her underwear. But it was attributed to another cause, not from human blood. Okay, so having said all this, in order for a kefen to be a problem, we have to have all of these five factors that you have in your nose in order to be a problem. Any one of these is not there, then the kefen would not run to her anita midraba. However, caution with kesama. Always remember that. Though the woman is not anita, Rav Mordechai Willen, and as well as others like Rav Vazna from Bnei Brak, suggest that a couple avoid intercourse for 24 hours if the woman experiences spotting in the middle of her cycle, which is logical. Though it doesn't render the woman anita, she still has to wonder why she's spotting. It could be the advent of a period that's irregular. So she has to be careful. That's not sakalacha, but it is a very strong advice. And another question with kesamim, anytime there's spotting that has a thickness to it, or it's a significant amount, let's say it was on a colored garment, so it's larger than a penny, but since it's on color, it's going to be okay. But if it's a significant amount, she has a lot of bleeding, and even though it's in the middle of the period, she should call her up, because who knows, maybe she's bleeding, and it is actually a period, but it's irregular. Okay, so far we've discussed being a nida, having a hargasha, and having kesem. The fourth category is having a baby. During active labor, a woman becomes a nida. When is active labor? Many poskim discuss this issue. We're going to go through some ideas, such as a bloody show. What is a bloody show? Bloody show, the doctors describe as when the mucus plug in the cervix comes out. So in some women, it happens at once. And when the mucus plug comes out, it has some bloody tissues in it, and it's like a bloody spotting on whatever it is, her garments. So when women experience this, they get very concerned that they're anita. Even though they're still pregnant, they still might not even be in labor. Labor might not occur for actually 2 weeks, but there's all this blood all of a sudden. Definitely, if that would happen to you, call up your rabbi, discuss it. But I'm telling you, according to most poskim, a bloody show does not render the woman anita. It actually isn't technically uterine blood. It's the blood of that mucus plug that's in the cervix. Many women don't even experience the bloody show because it comes out in slow drips and drabs and disintegrates and just disappears and you don't even see it. Some women do, and then they get all concerned, oh, I'm anita, even though I didn't have a baby yet. So no, ask the shaila. Most rabbanim will say, you're not an anita. When the water breaks, some say, oh, when the woman's water breaks, renders her anita. It's a machlokas. When you hear that word, know that there are differences of opinion, and that means ask your rab. And don't ask your rab when your water breaks. Ask your rab when you're pregnant, when you're close to childbirth, what his position is. If actually the water breaking renders you anita. But for all opinions, when does the woman become anita? When she's in active labor means when she can't walk anymore. When her dilation of the cervix is so great, she wouldn't be able to walk. And that doesn't mean when they strap you down because they gave you the epidural. It means when, if you were able to walk, in theory, you were free to walk around the hospital, you wouldn't be able to walk. So at that point, you're in active labor because the dilation is so great. Let's talk about after childbirth. So after childbirth, it's common to have a flow for 4 to 6 weeks. And over time, it ebbs. So don't be disappointed. If this has never happened to you yet, don't be disappointed if it goes back and forth and you think, oh, great, I'm going to be able to, you know, do my Zion and came and get to the mikvah, and then all of a sudden, the bleeding starts again. My advice to those of you who will come to experience this for the first time is avoid strenuous activity. And then hopefully you'll heal and heal very fast and go through the process. Anyway, today we treat this blood flow as a regular nida process. And there's much more than a minimum of 5 days before the seventh. for the Zayinikim. But I'm going to talk about the way it used to be Min HaTorah for the purposes of answering the question before, just to show you how you could have uterine blood without being in need of Min HaTorah, and also to explain a situation of a miscarriage. Okay, so Min HaTorah, the way it was, when a woman gave birth to a male, she would be tameh for or tameh for 7 days, then she would be tovel in the mikvah. And then she would have something called dam tohar for 33 days. Well, even though she was bleeding, she was considered tohar. When she gave birth to a female, she would be tameh for 14 days and tohara for 66 days afterwards. And after these, all these days, she would fall into the normal cycle. Today, women accepted counting 7 clean days for end uterine blood. And they disregarded this whole notion of dam tohar, of having bleeding and still being tohar. It doesn't exist today. But for the purposes of discussing, in theory, a miscarriage, we have to know about this. Why? Okay, first of all, just on the subject of miscarriage, 1 in every 10 pregnancies is a miscarriage. That doesn't mean 1 in every 10 people have miscarriages. It means 1 in every 10 pregnancies, there are women with 8 to 10 children who have had miscarriages. It's not uncommon to have a miscarriage, especially in the first month or two, because it signals that there's a genetic abnormality and it's nature's way of not having a fetus that's not viable. If a woman, in theory, conceived, but it was before 40 days that she had the miscarriage, she would go through the regular Mitzvah process. She'd need a minimum of 5 days of Harchakos, 7 days of Zayinikim. Well, if it were after 40 days, she knew that she could trace when conception was, and she knew that now, took a pregnancy test, she knows that she's pregnant, and it's post 40 days since she became pregnant, but it's too early when she has the miscarriage to know if she was carrying a boy or a girl, then she has to think of the following. Usually, even what I'm saying now doesn't apply because women tend, when they have miscarriages, to bleed a lot for many days. What if, in theory, I know there are just these super women out there. I see, like, the way they just, you know, walk around after they give birth. They're super women. They must heal very quickly. So, in the case of a superwoman who had a miscarriage and doesn't know if she gave birth to a boy or a girl, she has to be careful that post having that miscarriage, which could have been a girl, she doesn't go to the mikvah before day 14. Because Min HaTorah, she has to wait 14 days before going to the mikvah when she has a girl. So that would mean she can't just wait a minimum of 5 days of her chakos and then 7, because if minimally she only bled 5 days, which is very theoretical after a miscarriage, but in theory it could happen with these superwomen that heal very quickly, then she would end up at the mikvah at day 12. That's too early. Min HaTorah, she needs 14 days if she gave birth to a girl. Why is there a difference between giving birth to a boy, it's only 7 days before she could go to the mikvah Min HaTorah, and 14 for a girl? The Or HaChaim, HaKadosh, describes that, going back to our understanding, what Nida means, it's a signaling of a loss of life, a void of potential. When the woman is carrying a boy, she has life inside her, and then the life departs her, so she has like a vacuum of Kedusha, a void of Kedusha there, so she's in the status of a Tameah. If she gives birth to a girl, she had a girl who herself has the potential to carry life, so exponentially she has a greater level of Kedusha. That's the Or HaChaim HaKadosh's understanding why there's double the number of days of Tameah for a girl. Okay. Next category, fifth category, medical examination can render the woman in Egypt. This is not so common today. But we'll go into it just in case it comes up and you'll see what the issues are. The issue most relevant is psichas akever. The dilation of the uterine opening can render the woman in nida if it's at a certain size of dilation. So Chazal assumed at a specific size of dilation that inevitably there would be a discharge of uterine blood that would render the woman in nida. As it says in Gemara Nida Daf Chaf Aleph on the base, she'i afshar l'psichas hakever below that. It's impossible to dilate the opening of the uterus without there being blood emitted. But the question is, does this only refer to the body dilating the uterus internally on its own? Or does it also apply when the doctor externally dilates the uterus with a speculum or something like that? So the Nozomi Yehuda, modern posse, Great Gadol said, yeah, even if it's externally induced dilation, it would render the woman immediate if it was at a certain size. So Poskim discuss what size dilation would cause the woman to be the nida status. And you see on the sheet in front of you, therefore, a range of questions to pose if you were undergoing such a procedure. So, for example, what instrument are you using? What is the circumference of it? What are you doing with it? Where is it going? And please tell me if I should expect to see blood and where it be coming from. Now, having said all this is the most important thing I will tell you. It comes up all the time. And that is, when you choose an OBGYN, it doesn't matter if it's going to be someone from or Jewish or not. It has to be someone, bottom line, that respects halacha. And it respects your right to ask questions. And just note that if you have the opportunity to have an OBGYN that is from, male or female, that doctor is not a rav. And there have been situations with doctors who are Yerei Shamayim and told the woman, this procedure renders you a nida. And the woman came back to me and told me that, and I said, I'm almost positive it doesn't. Why are you listening to your doctor? Call up your rav. Sure enough, the rav said, no, it doesn't. And sometimes the rav will say, no, and this is what you should do to obviate any potential shilas that may come up. So always ask your rav. Don't trust your doctor. Your doctor is very good at being a doctor, but he is not a rav. She is not a rav. Okay. Now let's go to the process of becoming tahora. These notes are not available to you right here, but if you would want them, feel free to write down your email address for me. I left the paper in the back, and I'll send them to you. Or maybe if you post this here online somehow, I'll give you them as downloadable source. Question? I need a nidah. Yeah. I can't hear you, so I'm sorry.
No. Good question. So if you know that the stain of kesem is attributable to another source like a dye, you don't have to wait 24 hours. We're talking about where it's a bodily discharge that may signal the onset of menstruation.
Good question. Okay. The process of becoming tahora. We're doing well time. Starts with a hefsek tahora. Hefsekara is a bedika, but we'll call it the ultra deluxe bedika. You cannot start Zayin Nikiyin without this bedika. Its purpose is to determine that blood has stopped. The blood flow has stopped, she's knocking me down. A woman may do a hefsekara as soon as she has two things in place. Number one, bleeding has stopped. Number two, there was a minimum of 5 days of her chakos, or 5 days since she halachically separated from her spouse. Where do these 5 days come from? And by the way, I think this is a common misunderstanding as well. Everyone talks about 5 days, and they incorrectly think it's 5 days, minimum 5 days of bleeding, or post-bleeding. It has nothing to do with blood. It has to do with her chakos. Separated. Why? Chazal understood that a woman could never do bedika and be tahora if in the bedika process, she was also poletas shechfas zera. She was emitting semen. So, to make sure that she only starts the process of doing bedikos after she could have had no more semen inside her, they said wait 5 days from the last possible moment that she could have had intercourse. Just to understand that a little deeper. So, let's say she becomes a nida on, I'll take a different example. She doesn't become a nida on Sunday. Let's say on Sunday, she spotted. So, like we said, the advice is don't have intercourse. So, halachically, she separated from her husband. And maybe she even rendered herself a nida. She said she was a nida, and she thought that was the beginning of the period. I think let's get that example. It's a little bit halakhically clearer. So, she rendered herself a nida. but she actually didn't have a flow of blood yet. She realized later that there was nothing doing, and her period only began on Tuesday. But on Sunday, she rendered herself nidah and began keeping her chuppahs. Okay, so then Sunday is day, if it's before she had day one. Monday is day two. Tuesday is day three. She happened to have a period also then, but that was okay. Thursday is day four. Friday is day five. In theory, if her period was only 3 days, she could still have a hefsek tara on Friday before Shkia, because she has 5 days of her chuppahs. And where did the 5 days come from? Semen is viable, Chazal say, for 72 hours, or three full days, nights and days. And then they tack on, like a bookend on either end, just in case that last possible moment that she couldn't have been with her husband as at this ambiguous time of Bein HaShemoshot, like the time between sunset and the stars coming out, between Shkia and Tzitza Kochanu. It doesn't matter if you don't fully grasp what I'm saying, as long as you know where, in general, those 5 days come from. It has to do with a woman being halakhically separated and not having the opportunity to have intercourse and therefore not having semen viable after 5 days inside her, so she could start anxiety king. Okay, so let's do a regular example. Sunday before Shkia, the woman becomes a nida. And then Thursday is day five. Sunday before Shkia is day one, Monday two, Tuesday three, Wednesday four, Thursday five. So she does her hefsek tara before Shkia. And it's clear, it's clean. What is Thursday? Day zero. And I was told by a different Rebbetzin that this is another common misconception. For some reason, people got confused. They don't realize that day zero. Day one of Zion Kiyam is the next day after the Hefsek Tara, meaning it starts that night. Okay. To do the Bedika, to do this Hefsek Tara, woman should wash internally, bathe, or shower, or use a damp cloth or a wipe, and then she uses a Bedika cloth. A Bedika cloth is known as her aid or her witness. It shows what's going on inside her. It has to be a clean, white piece of cloth that's cotton, that's absorbable. It has to be 3 knuckles by 3 knuckles, or let's say 3 inches by 3 inches around. She wraps it around her finger, she inserts it into the vaginal canal, she rotates it 360 degrees and in all the crevices, and she removes it. What if the woman doesn't have a bedika cloth on her? She could still use something else. She could use a white pair of underwear. She could use a white t-shirt. You don't only have to use a bedika cloth. And that goes for the middle of Zion Kiyam as well. You could take off the white underwear you're wearing and use it for the bedika and then put it back on. Okay. And when you look for the colors on that bedika cloth to see if you're okay, you have a good hefsek tara, go through those colors that I mentioned and err on the safe side of asking a shayla, especially if you're unsure in the beginning, before you get used to knowing what will be problematic. Just err that it might be problematic and ask a shayla on any color that's in the realm of red, so even orange. What if she is doing this hefsek tara and she doubts that it's not good? Maybe it came out pink. It's not clear, it's not white, it's not off-white, it's not pale yellow. She could repeat it, as long as it's not Shkia yet. And repeat it as many times as you want, but don't irritate yourself. You're very dry at this time of the month, so easily, like, what you need is one tiny little blood cell, and then you get stuck on a bedika cloth. You don't want that. So, my advice, and again, every woman is different, don't do it more than 3 to 4 times in a half an hour, because you may irritate yourself. You're able to do it over and over, but there has to be some time delay in between. Most rabbis suggest at least 2 to 3 minutes before you do the next one. Because if in theory something was flowing, how would you know? If you just wiped it away the first bedika, then try to do another hefsek tara, nothing's there yet, because you didn't give it time to flow. So give it at least 2 to 3 minutes if potentially something was flowing, yeah. Yes, I'm getting to that. Yes, good question. Okay, great. What if it's pink and she feels like this is internal residue? I know for a fact I haven't had to use a pad in 24 hours. I don't have my period, but it's coming out pink. Most likely there's residue from the period. How do you get rid of it? You just want to get a clean, have sex power, ideally. So what do? Bathe, like you're saying, or do a douche. That's French for shower. So use one of those bottles with the applicator that you put inside you and you squeeze and gives you an internal shower. And actually get rid of all the internal residue. Take the douche with you to work if you're going to be somewhere and you don't have a bath. But know that once you, it's different. When you wash yourself internally, like you're asking, you have to wait more time. Because when you clean yourself with water, the blood flow stops for longer. So wait, most postmen will say 15 to 20 minutes. Means if you could wait 20 minutes, wait 20 minutes. If you're in a crunch and it's right before Shkia, wait at least 15 minutes before you do that bedikah. Leave yourself time. When is the ideal time to do a hefsek tahara? Ideally, the woman should not start the process until halachically hour and a half before, 1.5 halachic hours before Shkia. Why? So that it's close to the onset of the first of the 7 days of Zion King. We don't want her to start a hefsek tahara process too close to Shkia because she's under a tremendous amount of time pressure and then she might have an issue if she wants to douche or wash herself internally and so on. Look up the time of Shkia when you have your period so you know already what the timing is. It's essential. One time my husband got a shayla from a very disappointed husband. Said, I was on the cell phone with my wife and I said, did you do your hefsek tahara? And she said, oh no, I'm going to run and do it now. He had a cell phone, knows exactly what time she went to do it. And then they looked up Shkia afterwards, and to their chagrin, Shkia was before the time that she went to go do hefsek tahara. So you don't want to fall into that situation. You don't want to be just at the buzzer right after Shkia. It has to be before Shkia. And if you were in that situation, I still would call up your rav, but and ask, you know, maybe the rav would find some way of being makeup. But no, it has to be before Shkia. And make sure that you do a hefsek tahara, know what Shkia is. However, on that note, I'll get to your question in a second. It is advisable to do an insurance check in the morning. I say insurance, like insurance. So this is an insurance check. On the morning, if you aren't bleeding anymore, in the morning of your hefsek tahara, why do you want to do an insurance check? For two reasons. To avoid that woman's situation, to avoid a situation where you forget later, and then you can't have your day zero. Your day zero is going to be minimally tomorrow. You can't do your hefsek tahara till tomorrow. But what if, again, so the woman has her period before Shkia on Sunday, so she's finished bleeding by Thursday, right? And Thursday morning, she does her insurance check, but then her day is crazy busy and she forgets. Know the following, that, as I said, ideally, she should be doing hefsek tahara closer to Shkia, like an hour and a half before Shkia. But busy at it, after the fact that she forgot, the insurance check will count as her hefsek tahara. So it's a very good policy. Another reason it's a good policy to check in the morning, do a bedikah in the morning, is because it tells you what's going on. It shows you if it's coming out pink, then you know you need a douche. Possibly, if you're going to be away from the bath. So that in case there's internal residue that's still sitting there and you're really determined to get a hefsek tahara that's clean, you'll have the douche with you. Yes, you asked the question. Yes.
Okay. I think what you're asking is as follows. If you're using a damp cloth, like let's say a baby wipe, to clean inside, do you have to wait 15 to 20 minutes? I'm not gonna pass it. I'm just telling you, like, logically, I would think that it's not what Chazal are talking about. It's not, you're not cleaning yourself internally with, like, a rush of water. So I think that would be the same thing as the 2 to 3 minutes. You wouldn't stop the flow of the blood, like, the douche for the, or the bath, or the bath. It's a great question. I guess you could ask me about that question.
Yes, other questions?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of the questions emailed to me. Okay, so the question is, let's say simplify your question. The question I was asked on email was related. So let's say you do you have satire, but you don't have white underwear on you. Great. The answer is, do the hesketara, wear your black underwear, and as soon as you can, put on white underwear. You'll see why. You'll see where the idea of wearing white underwear comes from. Other question? Thank you for that expert scientific point. That just know that this is not the reason why we do nitya. We have a whole class on hashkafa of benefits of keeping tarot from hashkafa. There are many, many benefits emotionally and physically and so on, and it's so in sync with the woman's physiology and endocrinology or her hormone system. It's totally in sync, but that's not why we keep nitya. Rather, that is the icing on the cake or the reason for appreciating it, but more so like Lisa was saying, just know that the halacha that you have to wait 15 to 20 minutes after washing yourself internally before doing the bedikah is also to your advantage physically, because when you wash yourself, you do make yourself drier and you wouldn't want to irritate yourself. Great. So, another question, yes? Yes, you have to, according to posting, you're supposed to clean yourself. It's part of the process. Clean yourself before you do the hesed tara.
Like the insurance check in the morning, so there's no cleaning
beforehand,
that maybe
you didn't
know, or?
It still would count. The cleaning yourself is, it's not the hack. Okay? Clean yourself is written in the halacha. You're supposed to clean yourself. It's part of the process, but it's not the hack. If you didn't, it's still okay. Okay. Now, once she has a valid hesed tara before Shkia, she can go to the next step. She's finished with day zero. What's the next step? A mof tachah. What is a mof tachah? Are these questions related to mof tachah? Okay, so we're going back in time. Yes. No. Do not wet a cloth to clean yourself from hesed tara. Though it might sound uncomfortable, use your hand and water. Or use a douche. You're allowed to douche on Shabbos. If you want to clean yourself before Hesed Tara on Shabbos, douche if you want to douche, or use your hand. To clean yourself internally, I guess you would be best off douching. And you can do that on Shabbos. There was another question in this area. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. Oh, if it's confusing, you forget it. The reason I'm calling day to the Hesed Tara day zero is to make sure you don't think day one of Zion King. Yes, it is. Good. Thank you for clarifying. When I say zero, I mean you're ready to kick off. You're starting Zion King, but you're not there yet. Okay.
So now, a moftacha means a spongy cotton cloth that's pushed in deeply. After a valid hesed tara, wait until a few minutes before Shkia, and then take another bedikah cloth and insert it as deeply as possible, and leave it inside like a tampon. You could leave that thread in the bedikah cloth hanging out so you can pull it out. You leave the moftachah in right before Shkia until after Tzitzit Kochavim. That is the time period of Bein Hashmashos, or between the suns, that ambiguous time frame when you don't know if it's, again, using my previous case, Thursday or Friday, halachically. Why are you leaving a moftachah in at that time? Because we're trying to demonstrate that the woman was nakim dam, or free of blood, at the first moment that Zion Nakim began. And how do we know when that first moment of Zion Nakim is? We know it only because the bedikah cloth is inside her during that moment, which must occur sometime between me and Hashmashos. You should ask your Rav, keep in mind that there are various opinions about how long that time, that ambiguous time period lasts. So more lenient amount of time is 20 minutes. More stringent times for Beit HaShemashos last an hour. My husband recommends that women ask the Rav to verify that they should not leave the Mohel Nachat in longer than necessary, because it could irritate. And also try to limit your activity when you have a Mohel Nachat in, because you're very dry at this time of the month, it could irritate. Now, this process of the Mohel Nachat is called a Chumra B'alma. That means it's a universal stringency. It is a Chumra. And it's very important that you know that. Because if it feels like it's irritating, and if you have an experience where you take it out and you see it in a spot of red, that usually is a sign that it's just an irritation. If it's a streak, very likely there's still some flow. But if it's a spot, it usually is a signal that it's irritation. So you show it to the Rav and he says, okay, you know, that renders you still in Egypt, so wait till tomorrow to do it again. But discuss it with your Rav, because very likely the Rav will say to the woman who's easily irritated by Moltachak to not do a Moltachak. And I'm telling this to you only so you don't feel guilty about it. It's a Chumra Ba'alma. Women accepted the stringency upon themselves to prove that they were Naki Nidam, free of blood, right at the first start of Zion Kiyam. But it's a Chumra, so if your body is likely to be irritated, then don't do the Moltachak. Yes. Yeah, so you're asking if the woman every time she does Mohel Nachat irritates herself, should she just stop doing Mohel Nachat? So my response to you is, like, notice I've been repeating myself, that I would ask the Rav. So ask the Rav and the substantiate that there's no need for you to do Mohel Nachat. Don't, like, pass it for yourself. Yeah. Another question. So preventative medicine. So you know that when you have a Mohel Nachat, you're not going to limit your activity. You're going to have chasing kid around, and very likely it will irritate. Again, I would say, ask Ashala to your Rav. And I'm confident that your Rav will tell you don't do the Mohel Nachat, but that doesn't preclude asking the Ashala to the Rav. Yes. Another question. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. No, if your most often fell out before the time that you were going to take it out, there's no need to ask yourself. It's fine. That's what I'm trying to tell you. It's not halachically ma'akib. You don't need a most often to like be inducted into Zion Kiyam. You don't need it. It's an extra. It's a stringency. The icing on the cake. Everyone accepted upon themselves. Women over all kinds of accept this form of Amma. But knowing that I'm telling this, would answer your question. If it fell out prematurely, it's okay. Right. Great question. Okay, very important. It's Hotzah if you're wearing a moth and you go outside of an Erev on Shabbos. I'm not going to go into why. You could understand why. If you want to think about it, if you want to ask me about it, I'll explain later. Although Rabbanim do not allow a tampon to do a bedika because it doesn't go into crevices, know that some say it's okay to use a tampon for a Mohel Nachat. Okay, what do you do once the Mohel Nachat is removed? Inspect it like you would another kind of bedika. Make sure that on both sides of it, there is no spot that could be problematic. Okay, once you've gone through Hefsek Tara, you've gone through the Mohel Nachat process, you're in the running, you're in Zion Kiyam. What do you wear during Zion Kiyam? The minhag is halvashas levonim, wear white. So you wear white underwear, completely white. Make sure that they're not stains in any way that might later cause you to second guess yourself. And you should look and see if they're stained after you wear them. Anything that stains on the underwear is subject to all those criteria of the keset. So yes, they will be on white, but it's still subject to the fact that it has to be of a certain size and so on. It's not like a bedika cloth. And a bedika cloth, the tiny speck of red is a problem. But even during Zion Kiyam, on underwear, tiny speck of red is not a problem because it's a keset. It's a different status. Okay, so if you know that you have issues with spotting, you have issues during Zion Kim all the time, talk to your rabbi about it. There may be preventative ways to solve the issue of always having to restart Zion Kim. For example, your rabbi might tell you, just keep changing your white underwear so you never have a significant size of a spot. And that's okay. If you know you're going, I just got the shayla. A woman's going to have a pap smear during Zion Kim, although I would recommend not schedule that during Zion Kim. Do it during when you're in Nida, ideally. At the end of the period that you're in, the time that you're in Nida. But any, for any reason, she was getting a pap smear during Zion Kim, like day five of Zion Kim, can you imagine? So she said, what do I do? So she asked the shayla, and the answer was that whatever spotting would be from the pap smear. But just to rule out having a problem, since you are wearing white normally during Zion Kim, don't wear white, because you know already that you're going to have spotting. Very likely you'll have some kind of spotting from the pap smear. Some people don't have any bleeding from a pap smear. But just wear colored garments during Zion Kim. Even though you're a Zion Kim, but you know you're going to have spotting because of the medical procedure, so wear colored garments. That's an example. I'm not telling you so that you could, again, decide for yourself, but to know to ask the shayla. Then, again, we're not circumventing the system. This is the system. The Rabbanim created the chumras, they created the kulas too. Now, some say also during Zion Kim it's preferable to use a white sheet on one's bed. Some have the minhag to also wear a white nightcap. But it's written that nowadays women are usually wearing white underwear, even to sleep. So then, if so, a woman would not also need the white nightgown and the white sheet. Basically, the minhag is that which is closest to her body should be white. So we're presuming, by saying she doesn't need a white sheet, that she is wearing white underwear to sleep. What does a woman do during the rest of Zion Kim? Ideally, two daily zikos, one in the morning and one in the afternoon before Shkia. This is different than the Hesitar. She should not wash herself before these zikos in the middle of Zion Kim. And she should keep track. So the Torah says, the Safralah, she should count on herself. The Shalah points out it. It's ideal to actually say, this is day five, either verbally or mentally. Tell yourself, this is day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. It makes it chavim, it makes it special. It's like Sfiras Omer, you're counting up to something exciting, like Matan Torah. This is counting up to when you're going to the mikveh. It makes it very exciting, it's easier to keep track. But if she doesn't count, it's still valid. She doesn't have to halachically count in order to do Zion Kim properly. Now, this is the biggest question. So, what if in the middle of Zion Kim she finds a pink stain on the bedikah cloth? What does she do next? Scenario is, so again, same situation. Thursday, before she did a hefsekar. So now comes Sunday, all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, everything was fine, but all of a sudden, this bedikah is pink. This bedikah cloth comes out pink. What does she do? She has to hedge her bets. She has to know her situation. She has to know the way her body works. And she has to figure out what to do next. First of all, that first bedikah cloth that was pink, she's going to show it to her rug. Mark down, this is bedikah number one for day, what would this be? Number three, if it was Sunday in that situation. Aside from showing that bedikah cloth to her rug, she should think proactively, strategically, what should I do next? It could be she's just going to decide, let's wait and see if that one's okay. A woman who is likely to be irritated by doing another bedikah would just wait and wait it out. Hopefully the bedikah is fine, and then she just is, that's fulfills day three, and Monday is day four. But could be she's concerned that pink bedikah cloth is a problem. And if she waits till the rav tells her, very likely he will only be able to tell her the next day. So at best, she'll only be able to restart Zion Kim on Monday, and that will be what I call day zero. Okay, it won't be day one, because she would not have done a hefsek tara to restart the whole equation. So what she might want to do is, after she gets the first one that's pink, wait some amount of time and do a second one. That is advantageous only if she thinks the second one will be better, and that the second one will be clean and that it will, in essence, if the first one was a problem, be her new hafsakara. Was that clear? Okay. Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm gonna definitely emphasize. Thank you. Always label if you're going to do
more than one bedikah on a day. Always label what was the first and what was the second, and so on, so it could affect what her status is in the end. So the advantage of checking, again, doing a recheck in the middle of Zion Kippur, again, is you're hoping that the next one will be better. Ideally, both will be fine, and then you'll be in the middle, and you won't have three counts. But if the first one is a problem, at least you'll have a new hafsakara if you can get the second one to be clear, white or off, white or pale yellow. Question? Okay, now I understand your question. Okay, the question is, great question. We're told that halachically what shows a valid color is sunlight. So you're asking, when you're ascertaining if you would have to do another tzika or not, you're in the middle, it's like the valid tzika, and there's no sunlight around, can you just assume if it looks clear, then it's clear? Yes. Yes. If it looks clear to you and your lighting is acceptable, not totally dim, yeah. It looks clear, white, off white, or pale yellow, you're totally fine. Throw it out. You're in day whatever you are. Right. And frankly, if you are told to look in sunlight, I would say, like, that's already a reason to ask a child. Like, if you would have to think to look in the sunlight to ascertain if it's pink enough, then ask a child on. But if you're asking me if, in the context of what I just raised, to know if you think it's probably going to be okay if you should do an extra bedika, yeah, then the question that you're asking is very relevant, because you want to know, you want to hedge your bets properly. Maybe this bedika that looks pink is not really pink. So then your point is a good one. So then what she's saying is, don't judge that this one is really a problem because you're looking at it in this kind of fluorescent lighting. Go in sunlight and then see, does it really look like a problem? If you want to hedge your bets, just to be educated, not to pass in the shame, just to be educated to know if you should do an extra bedika. Then yeah, then look in sunlight. Okay. Right. There are some people who say if you're new at this and it's pale yellow, ask a shiny. I don't teach challah that. If it's pale yellow, do not ask a challah. It's fine. It's only if you have a question that is on its way to orange. I say deep golden yellow. These colors don't mean anything to the average person. If you're artistically inclined, they might, but the point is if there's any highlight, a chance of a red highlight there, then ask. If you don't see at all a red highlight, then don't. Yeah. Checking in the middle of Zion Kippur, if you see a pink bezika fund, let's say, is that the first could be a problem and you're hoping the second will be okay, and at least it will be a new hafsakara. The con is the first may have been fine, the second may be worse. The conclusion is only recheck if you think the next one will be better and you'll eventually have a new hafsakara. Question, another question that comes up is, what if she forgets to do a bezika? Okay. Mit ikar hadin. The halacha is she must have done a bedika on day one, and she must have done a bedika on day seven. The normal practice is to do, like we said, two bedikos all of the 7 days. And she should be very careful on the first couple of days if there are any of those shilohs pending. If you've got questionable bedikas that might make you recalibrate something into a new day one. So think about it. If on day one you did a bdika, and then day two it was pink, and then day three you forgot to do your bdika, but then you don't have a new day one there. You're going to have to start from day zero the next time, the next day. What if the woman forgets to do a bdika on day one or day seven? It's extremely serious, and she has to call a barel. It's a serious question. It could be he'll find a reason that will be okay, but that's a very serious question. But what if a woman, not on purpose, but after the fact, realizes she forgot to do a bdika on day two, three, four, five, six? Do not bother calling a barel. It's okay. After the fact, you're all right. Unless one of those days was the new day one because you had a problem in the middle and you had to start Zion Kim because of a problematic color on a particular cloth from an earlier day. There are some who have a dangerous practice. There are some women out there that say, oh, Christ, you're telling me it's all right. I just do one particular on day one and one particular on day seven. It's seriously dangerous practice because think about it, if you do particular on day one and you don't do any more until day seven, very likely will forget on day seven. However, for the woman who forgets on day seven and falls on the rug and can't find a reason to be lenient, but she did a bdika on day two, can do another bdika on day eight. And then day two to day eight is a continuum of 7 days. So that's the bookend that she needs to qualify as having fulfilled Zion Nikia. That's why it would be very, very important to keep doing them every single day until they said yes. Okay, so for the curious in us, how could a rabbi be lenient if she forgot to do bdika on day one or day seven? Okay. The answer would be the rabbi would discuss with you what you did that day. Could be some action that you did qualifies after the fact as in lieu of a bdika. Like, let's say you inserted something, even maybe it could be toilet paper. In this situation, the rabbi could use it to your advantage and say, oh, and you saw that and you inserted it like enough and it was clean. In theory, that could, you know, be an alternative to a valid bdika. I'm not saying it is, I'm just saying that there are rabbis who could potentially go to great lengths to make the woman okay. So don't avoid asking the child. Even if you feel like, oh, that was really silly of me, ask the child, you may still be okay. The doctor told you not to do anything in the vaginal area because of the irritation. Let's say something that you know is an irritation, or call it a maka. So how do you go about doing Zion Kiyum? Call your rabbi. That's a good question, but beyond our purview, really depends on what the issues are. Definitely the rabbi would try to be, give you the least irritable kind of system to use to go through Zion Kiyum, but that's very tailor-made for the situation, so ask your rabbi. Okay, so just to finish up, the last day, or the seventh day of Zion Kiyum leads up to the night going to the mikvah. If she did a valid hafsek tahara, let's say it was on Sunday before Shkia, then she would go to the mikvah the next Sunday next Sunday night after Tetzach Kochavim. But what happens if she doesn't go to the mikvah? For whatever reason, she can't go to the mikvah, or she doesn't get around to going to the mikvah, it's the middle of her three yantif and her mikvah is so far away, whatever. But what does she do? After she does the last week on day 7, put on colored underwear and do nothing else and just wait until you get the chance to go to the Mecca. You don't have to keep doing tikkos and keep wearing white. Do not keep wearing white. Finish. And then whenever you go to Mecca, you'll discuss next week how to prepare and go. Now, back to the question that we had before. So, an unusual situation. A woman who is likely to be irritated. What should you do? Again, I'm going to tell you. Ask your Rav, because there are different approaches. Some Rabbanim will say to put warm water on the bedikin cloth before you do it, and still tell you to do 2 bedikos. Some will say put KY jelly on the bedikin cloth. Some will say only do 1 bedika a day. Depending on the woman, they might even say don't do bedika every day. So it really depends on the woman. So you have to talk to your Rav to figure out what's best for you. Final point, and this is very rare. A woman who all of a sudden, you know, she has such irregular cycles that she could be in the middle of Zayin and start a mini period. She's so rare. Why I'm bringing this up is, if in theory the woman knows that this is actually a period and it's smack in the middle of Zayin, and she has to then, let's say she starts this mini period, this irregular mini period, one morning of Zayin, but it finishes before Shia, and she tries to do a hesekara. So what I'm saying is, the bleeding stopped and started, a flow, an actual flow, stopped and started on the same day, and she wants to do a hesekara, she has to do a moch dachak in that case. It's not a chumra. It's mandatory to prove that she's actually not kimidam going into the zayin. If in that situation that the woman is doing hesekara on the same day her bleeding began. No, by the way, in this situation, what I'm saying, she has a period, it's an actual period, it's a mini period. Does she need to wait 5 days? No, because she's already waited 5 days post the last time she could have potentially had a tumor. So forget about those 5 days, just wait till she finishes the flow and she can restart the hesekara. Yeah. That is very to the point. So you're asking, essentially, I think you're asking, so what really in the middle of that came one day or at another time in the middle of the table? What is the difference between spotting and having an irregular period? That is the most relevant question. And very difficult to know. So to be on the same side, like we were talking about with Kesa, whenever you're siding, a significant amount pull up or rub and talk about what's going on. Is it siding or is it a mini period? That's just the regular. I can't tell you. There's nothing like specific. If I say X number of tablespoons of blood signals that it's a period and a rate of flow of a certain rate is a period. I don't know. I don't think it would be so meaningful anyway to the average person. So just know if you're spotting significantly, you should call it growth, because who knows if that's considered spotting mid-cycle and if it's considered a period. Yes? Yeah, sure. No, never. Once you've written in the event that we're talking about, you've all in the middle of the time, of course, you've already waited the 5 days, you don't need another 5 days, you're still in the middle of the time. You're still all completely in the status of the need to. You never have. You have yet gone to the mikvah, you don't need another 5 days. Yes? Okay. Great. So, to repeat the question. First, let's just get to the point. The person is on birth control, and the person stops during birth control. So presuming that it's spotting that doesn't require changing pads very often, okay, this is to answer your question. Now, so if you don't have to change pads over and over, I would say that's spotting versus a period. If you find that you have to change your pad more than once an hour, or I don't know, yeah, it's all pretty relative, that is more likely something like a period, like a regular period. It's very common. Actually, there are a lot of
three Torah being written up right now about certain methods of birth control that cause many periods. Inevitably, because, for example, there are birth control pills right now that are 3 months at a time. If you're on birth control that goes for 3 months at a time, you're not supposed to have your period for 3 months. But very often, women experience some spotting. The question is, if you experience a significant amount of spotting in the middle of a 3 month long birth control cycle, is that significant amount of spotting, like mid-cycle spotting, or is it a mini period? This is a huge halachic discussion that's going on. So ask Yora how he would go about that. Okay,
so I think that there has been a recurring thing throughout the evening, and I think that you're on a great track to going about this and then asking shalos. I think that there's been a wonderful sense of camaraderie here, and people are feeling very comfortable asking shalos. But I think that a big problem today is that people don't ask enough shalos, in Tarsa Mishpacha specifically. Women who hesitate to ask very often are very machmer. They end up being machmer. Their husbands tend to be a little less concerned than they are, so they're more meek. Usually the Rav is the most lenient, because he knows all the halacha. He really understands it. This goes on even in the frumest of communities. In a very, let's talk relatively, okay, what I would consider a very firm community, a shiur was given to men on, quote, the dangers of self-certification. And he didn't want to write it outright, I guess, in public, because the signs were posted everywhere. What are the dangers of self-certification? What does that mean? The dangers of paskening shilas for yourself. This was in a very firm community, quote-unquote, right-wing community. It was obviously going on. Well, how could they know that people were paskening shilas? Because the rav wasn't getting enough shilas, and the whole community wasn't pregnant. So that means there are people paskening their own shilas. Okay. So usually what you're doing is being machmer, it's like blowing a shofar on Pesach. It doesn't make any sense. You're not keeping the halakha properly, and you're being nego on Shalom Bayis. So don't feel inhibited to call up the Rav and ask a shalos. I can tell you from watching this firsthand, it's just for the Rav, the shalos is the same thing as asking him when you take your milk spatula and you put it in your fleischer pan and your frying onions, what are the statuses? So the same thing, you ask what he thinks about your bedikah cloth and your underwear. He really thinks of it as the same thing as that spatula and that frying pan. I know a woman who said to me, she was horrified. She spent Shana in Eretz Yisrael, a nice little shiva, and one day she gave her husband bedikah cloth to show to the Rav. That night he comes home and says, guess what happened? I gave your bedikah cloth to the Rav. And he thought that was such a great shaila. And he brought it up in the chabura today. And he showed it to everyone and he discussed, you know, the color of it. And her color drained from her face. And she said, what? Even all your friends were looking at my bedikah cloth. And he's like, what's the big deal? This was her husband speaking. He's doctor now, but he wasn't her Rav. And he said, what's the big deal? It's just a shaila. It's like a halachic discussion. What's the big deal? No one cares. She's like, okay, listen. I'm mature, I agree, but don't tell me when that happens again. So, just remember, a Rav has his own wife, and he's also brought her bedikos to a Rav, and he's very sensitive to your feelings, he understands what you're going through. At best, ask the Rav. If you can, ask his rebbetzin. If you can't do that, ask a mediator. But don't avoid asking a shaila. If it comes to slipping an envelope with your phone number or a Gmail address, then do that under his door. But ask a shaila. Don't avoid asking shailas. There's a story with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, told by his son-in-law, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Pendler. I think it was at Moshe Feinstein's funeral. He said, my father-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, never, ever got angry. I never saw him get upset. One time he got upset at him. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was in the process of passing in a shaila for a woman to see if she would still be a nidah or it would be okay and she would be able to go to the mikvah, you know, if not in 2 or 3 days, the next day or something. So he called up Rabbi Tamer, because Rabbi Tamer has experience in biology, he's a biology professor, he has medical experience, to ask him to ask the doctor a certain question that would relate to the shaila. And the next day, Moshe called and asked Rav Tamler for the answer. Rav Tamler said, oh, I didn't get around to asking the doctor. And Rav Moshe Feinstein raised his voice and said, What are you talking about? This is about a woman being returned to her husband. You can't delay this shaila. It's so important. And we shouldn't delay it for ourselves. We shouldn't have a lackadaisical attitude towards asking shaylas and just be makar for ourselves in the same vein. The source that you have below you before the suggested reading says, so from our brachos daf dalad amud aleph, a description of the way David HaMelech was. I think few of us envision David HaMelech in this manner. Shekol malchei mizrach u'marav yoshvim agudos b'chvodam. That all of the kings, they sit in their majesty in groups with their honor and their splendor. Ani yadai v'luch l'chos b'dam v'v'shafir u'v'shalya k'dei l'tahar isha l'ba'ala. And David HaMelech says about himself, my arms are knee-deep in blood, trying to be permitting a wife to her husband. So if we think to ourselves, David HaMelech could have been sitting like kings in grandeur and majesty, and yet he bloodied his hands with all sorts of things that he needed to be able to pass Ganita Shalas, and if it wasn't beneath the dignity of David HaMelech to do this, to pass Ganita Shalas, it shouldn't be beneath our dignity to ask the Shalas. So, next week, we're going to go into Dr. Hatzablowski. Dr. Hatzablowski is going to go into halachot of vestos and how to prepare and go to the mikvah. You're welcome to stay and ask me as many questions as you like. And in addition, you can email me at maybrooks@msn.com. maybrooks@msn.com, or my phone number is 212-568-2869. And I wish you a lot of hatzlacha. Good night. I'll go over to you. I don't want to keep everybody. Unless you all want to hear each other's shilas. It's your call. Now the mic is on again.